"How did that bastard get in?"
the researcher at the terminal said softly.
"All faces are naturally free to enter,"
his neighbour answered quietly.
"It's pretty dull, isn't it? I expect you're disappointed, Mr. President."
Dr. Allen, director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, said to Ray Diaz as he led him past the rows of computer terminals.
"I'm no longer president,"
Ray Diaz said severely as he surveyed his surroundings.
"This is our nuclear weapons simulation center. Los Alamos has 4 of these centers, and Lawrence Livermore has 3.
2 objects caught Ray Diaz's eye as being not entirely dull. They looked new, with large displays and consoles with lots of fine knobs. He headed over to take a closer look, but Allen pulled him back.
"That's a game machine. The terminals here aren't for gaming, so we brought in 2 machines for relaxation."
Ray Diaz noticed another 2 not entirely dull objects. Transparent and structurally complicated, they contained a bubbling liquid. Again, he started over to take a look, and this time Allen shook his head with a smile and did not stop him.
"That one's a humidifier. The climate is dry in New Mexico. The other one's just a coffee machine. Mike, pour Mr. Ray Diaz a cup of coffee." "No, wait, not from that. I'll brew you up a cup of top-shelf roast in my office."
The only thing left for Ray Diaz to do was to examine the blown-up black-and-white photographs hanging on the wall. He recognized the skinny man wearing a hat and smoking a pipe as Oppenheimer. Then Allen directed his attention back to the bland terminals.
"These displays are obsolete," Ray Diaz said. "But behind them is the most powerful computer in the world, operating at 30 petaflops.
An engineer came up to Allen.
"Doctor, the AD4453OG is operational."
"Excellent,"
the engineer lowered his voice.
"We've suspended the output module,"
he said and glanced at Ray Diaz.
"Run it," Allen said, then turned to Ray Diaz. "See, we've got nothing to hide from the wall faces."
Then Ray Diaz heard tearing sounds and saw the people at the terminals ripping paper apart. Assuming that they were destroying documents, he muttered,
"Don't you even have a shredder?"
But then he noticed that they were tearing up blank copy paper. Then someone shouted,
"Over!"
And everyone cheered and tossed the shredded paper into the air, making the cluttered floor even more like a garbage dump.
"This is a simulation center tradition. When the first atom bomb was exploded, Dr. Fermi tossed torn paper into the air, and according to the distance the pieces drifted in the shock wave, he was able to accurately compute the yield of the bomb. Now we do the same thing for every simulation we run."
Ray Diaz brushed the paper from his head and shoulders and said,
"You run nuclear tests every day, but to you it's as easy as playing a video game." "It's not like that for us. We don't have supercomputers. We've got to do real tests. We do the same things, but the poor always end up being the nuisance."
"Mr. Ray Diaz, no one here is interested in politics."
Ray Diaz leaned in to take a closer look at the terminals, but saw only scrolling data and shifting curves. When he finally did locate some graphics, they were so abstract he couldn't make anything out. When he leaned toward another terminal, the physicist seated in front of it looked up and said,
"Mr. President, if you're looking for a mushroom cloud, it's not there."
"I'm not the president,"
Ray Diaz repeated as he accepted the coffee Allen handed him. Allen said,
"Then we ought to talk about what we can do for you."
"Design a nuclear bomb."
"Of course. Los Alamos may be a multidisciplinary institution, but I suspected you wouldn't be here for any other reason. Can you give me any specifics? What type? What yield?" The PDC will send you the completed technical requirements before long, so I'll just brief you on the key points. Large yield, the largest possible, as large as you can make it, 200 megatons at an absolute minimum.
Alan stared at him for a moment, and then bent his head in thought. That will require some time.
Don't you have mathematical models?
Of course we do. We have models for everything from 500-ton shells to large 20-megaton bombs, from neutron bombs to EMP bombs. But the explosive yield you're asking for is far too large. It's more than 10 times the world's largest thermonuclear device. It would have to have a totally different trigger and staging from a conventional nuclear weapon, and it might even require an entirely new structure. We don't have a model that fits.
They spoke some more about the general planning of various research projects, and when it came time to leave, Alan said, Mr. Ray Diaz, I know you have the best physicists on your staff at the PDC. I assume they've told you about the applications of nuclear weapons to space warfare.
You're permitted to be redundant.
Very well.
In space warfare, nuclear bombs may be low-efficiency weapons, since nuclear explosions produce no shockwave in the vacuum of space, and only negligible pressure from the light they generate, so they don't produce the mechanical impact found in explosions in the atmosphere. All their energy is released in the form of radiation and electromagnetic pulses, and, at least for humans, radiation and EM shielding on spacecraft is a fairly mature technology.
And if the target is directly hit?
That's a different thing altogether. In that case, heat will be a decisive factor, and the target may be melted or even vaporized. But one bomb of a few 100 million tons will probably be as big as a building, so I'm afraid it won't be easy to score a direct hit. In fact, the mechanical impact of nuclear weapons doesn't measure up to kinetic weapons. Their radiation is less intense than particle beam weapons, and their thermal destruction can't compare to gamma-ray lasers.
But those weapons aren't combat-ready. Nuclear bombs are humanity's most powerful mature weapons, and as for the performance issues you mention in space combat, ways can be found to improve them. Adding a medium to create a shockwave, for example, like putting ball bearings in a grenade.
That's an intriguing idea.
Your STEM background shows through.
My studies were in nuclear energy, which is why I like nuclear bombs. I've got a good feeling about them.
Alan laughed. I almost forgot. It's ridiculous to discuss issues like this with a wall-facer.
The two men laughed, but Ray Diaz quickly grew serious and said,
Dr. Alan, like everyone else, you're treating a wall-facer strategy as something mysterious. The most powerful combat-ready weapon available to mankind right now is the hydrogen bomb. Focusing on that is only natural, isn't it? I believe my approach is the correct one.
The two men stopped on the quiet path through the woods they had been walking along.
Alan said, Fermi and Oppenheimer walked down this road countless times. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, most of the architects of the first generation of nuclear weapons spent the rest of their lives mired in depression. They would be gratified if they knew the mission that humanity's nuclear weapons are now facing. No matter how frightening they might be, weapons are a good thing. Just to let you know, the next time I come, I hope I won't see you throwing scrap paper around. We should make a tidy impression on the Sofons.
Keiko Yamasuki woke up in the middle of the night to find herself alone, the sheets beside her cool. She got up, dressed, and went out the door. At first glance, she saw her husband's shadow in the bamboo grove in the yard as usual. They had homes in England and in Japan, but Heinz preferred his Japanese home. He said that the moonlight of the east calmed his heart. There was no moon tonight. The bamboo and his kimono-clad figure lost their dimensionality and looked like paper cuttings hung beneath the stars. Hines heard Keiko Yamasuki's footsteps, but did not look back. Strangely, Keiko wore the same shoes in England as in Japan. Even in her hometown, she never wore geta. But it was only here, never in England, that he could hear her footsteps.
"My love, you haven't slept properly for days," she said. Her voice was soft, but the summer insects stopped chirping and peace flooded like water over everything.
She heard her husband sigh. "Keiko, I can't do it. I can't think of anything. Really, I can't come up with anything at all."
"No one can. I say an ultimate victory plan doesn't exist."
She took two steps forward, but was still separated from Hines by a few stalks of bamboo. The grove was their place for contemplation, and the inspiration for most of their previous research had its source here. They rarely brought intimacy to this sacred place, but always addressed each other courteously, as befitted an atmosphere seemingly imbued with Eastern philosophy.
"Bill, you should relax. Doing the best you can is enough."
He turned round, but in the darkness of the grove his face was indistinct.
"How is that possible? Every step I take consumes a massive amount of resources."
"Then why not adopt this approach?"
Keiko's answer came swiftly. She had obviously been thinking about the question.
"Choose a direction that, even if you're unsuccessful, will do something beneficial while it is being carried out."
"Keiko, that's exactly what I've been thinking about. Here's what I've decided to do. Even if I can't come up with a plan, I can help other people think of one."
"What other people? The other wall facers?"
"No, they're not much better off than I am. I mean our descendants."
"Keiko, have you ever considered this fact? The outcome of natural biological evolution requires at least 20,000 years to manifest itself, but human civilization has just 5,000 years of history and modern technological civilization just 200. That means that the study of modern science today is being done by the brain of primitive man."
"You want to use technology to accelerate the brain's evolution?"
"We've been doing brain research, and we ought to put more effort into expanding it to a scale that can tackle a planetary defense system. If we work hard for a century or two, we might be able to increase human intelligence and allow the science of the future to break out of the Sophon's prison."
"Intelligence is a vague term in our field. What in particular?"
"I mean intelligence in the broadest sense of the word, not just the traditional meaning of logical reasoning, but learning ability, imagination, and innovation as well. And also, the ability to accumulate common sense and experience while preserving intellectual vigour and enhancing mental endurance so that a brain can think continuously without fatigue. And we can even consider the possibility of eliminating sleep and so forth."
"What will it take? Do you have even a rough idea?"
"No, not yet. Perhaps the brain can be connected directly to a computer, which can use its computing power to amplify human intelligence. Or maybe we can achieve a direct interface between human brains and blend different people's thoughts, or inherit memories. But whatever avenue we ultimately take to increase human intelligence, we must first begin from a fundamental understanding of the mechanisms of the human brain."
"And that's precisely our area of interest."
"We can continue in the same career as before. The difference will be that we can tap huge resources to do it."
"Love, I'm truly happy. I'm ecstatic. There's just one thing. As a wall facer,
Don't you think this plan is a little...
A little indirect? Maybe. But think about it, Keiko. Human civilization ultimately comes down to humans themselves. We start by elevating humans. Doesn't that make this a far-reaching plan? Besides, what else can I do?
Bill, you're wonderful.
So think about this for a moment. If we turn neuroscience and thought research into a world engineering project and can invest an inconceivably enormous amount of money in it, how long will we have to wait for success?
About a century, more or less?
Let's be a little more pessimistic and say 2 centuries. Then the highly intelligent humans will still have 2 centuries left. And if they use 1 century to develop fundamental science and another to turn those theories into technology, even if it fails, we'll have done what we wanted to do.
Keiko, come with me to the end of days, Hines murmured.
Yes, Bill, we certainly have the time.
The insects in the grove seemed to have grown accustomed to their presence and resumed their musical chirping. When a soft wind blew through the bamboo and the stars in the night sky flashed through the gaps between the leaves, it was as if the insect chorus was issuing from those stars. It was day 3 of the PDC's first Wallfacer project hearing. Ray Diaz and Hines had spoken about the first phase of their respective projects, which were put to preliminary discussion by representatives of the PDC permanent members. Ray Diaz and Hines had both submitted their plans at the previous hearing, but Tyler had delayed his first disclosure until this session, leaving representatives particularly eager for details. Tyler started with a brief introduction.
I need to establish an armed force in space that will supplement Earth's fleet but be under my command.
Just 1 sentence in, the hands of the 2 other Wallfacers shot up.
Mr. Hines and I have been accused of overuse of resources in our plans, Ray Diaz broke in, but this is absurd. Mr. Tyler wants to have his own space force?
I didn't say it was a space force, Tyler said calmly.
The intent is not to construct warships or large spaceships, but to establish a fleet of space fighters. They'll each be roughly the size of a conventional Earth-based fighter and will carry a single pilot. They'll be like mosquitoes in space. So I've dubbed this the Mosquito Swarm Plan. The formation needs to be at least equal to the size of the invading Trisolaran fleet, 1,000 ships.
You would attack a Trisolaran warship with a mosquito? That's not even going to raise a welt,
a hearing member said dismissively. Tyler raised a finger.
Not if each of those mosquitoes is equipped with 100-megaton-class hydrogen bomb. So I'm going to need the latest superbomb technology.
Don't turn me down immediately, Mr. Ray Diaz.
You can't turn me down, in fact. According to the principles of the Wallfacer project, that technology isn't your proprietary property. Once it's been developed, I have the right to requisition it.
Ray Diaz glanced up at him.
My question is, do you intend to plagiarize my plan?
Tyler smiled sardonically.
If a Wallfacer's plan can be copied, is he still a Wallfacer?
Mosquitoes can't fly very far, said Garanin, the PDC rotating chair.
These toy spacefighters can only engage in combat within the orbit of Mars, I believe.
Watch out. His next request might be for a space carrier, Hines said with a chuckle.
Tyler answered with aplomb,
That will be unnecessary. These space fighters can be networked to turn the entire squadron into a single entity, a mosquito group that acts as a space carrier and is propelled by an external engine or by the engines of a small portion of its member fighters. At cruising speed,
the group will possess the long-range space navigation capabilities of large spacecraft. Once it reaches the battlefield, the huge entity will disassemble and go into battle as a fleet of independent fighters. Your Mosquito group will take years to reach the defensive zone at the perimeter of the solar system. A fighter pilot can't spend such a long journey in a cockpit that doesn't even permit them to stand up. Will there even be room for supplies in such a small craft? Someone asked.
Hibernation, Tyler said. They'll have to hibernate. My plan relies on the realization of two technologies, miniaturized superbombs and miniaturized hibernation units.
Hibernating for a few years in a metal coffin, then waking up only to launch a suicide attack. Clearly the job of a Mosquito pilot is not one to be envied, Hines said. Tyler's enthusiasm disappeared, and he remained silent for a moment. Then he nodded.
Yes, finding pilots is the hardest part of the Mosquito Swarm plan.
Details of Tyler's plan were distributed to the members of the hearing, but there was no interest in discussion. The chair declared the hearing adjourned.
Luo Ji still hasn't arrived?
Asked the annoyed U.S. representative.
He won't be coming, said Garanin. He declared that his seclusion and non-participation in the PDC hearing is part of his plan.
At this, the attendees whispered among themselves. Some of them seemed annoyed, while others flashed cryptic smiles.
He's a deadbeat, a waste, Ray Diaz said.
Then what are you?
Tyler asked rudely, even though his Mosquito Swarm plan relied on Ray Diaz's super hydrogen bomb technology. Hines said,
I'd rather express my regard for Dr. Luo. He knows himself and knows his own abilities, so he doesn't want a pointless waste of resources.
He turned graciously to Ray Diaz.
I think Mr. Ray Diaz should learn something from him.
Everyone could see that Tyler and Hines were not defending Luo Ji, but that their enmity towards Ray Diaz was far deeper by comparison. Garanin rapped the gavel on the table.
First of all, Wallfacer Ray Diaz has spoken out of order. I remind you to show respect to the other Wallfacers. Similarly, I remind Wallfacers Hines and Tyler that your words are also inappropriate for this meeting.
Hines said,
Mr. Chair, what Wallfacer Ray Diaz has demonstrated in his plan is nothing but the crudeness of a soldier. Following in the footsteps of Iran and North Korea, his country fell under UN sanctions because of its nuclear weapons program, and this has given him a twisted complex for the bomb. There is essentially no difference between Mr. Tyler's Mosquito Swarm program and Ray Diaz's giant hydrogen bomb plan. Both are disappointments. The two straightforward plans will have their strategic intent exposed right from the start. Neither exhibits the canniness that's the strategic advantage of the Wallfacer project.
Tyler shot back.
Mr. Hines, your plan is like some sort of naive daydream.
When the hearing ended, the Wallfacers went to the meditation room, their favourite place in UN headquarters. It now seemed to them that this room, designed for silence, was built especially for Wallfacers. Gathered there, they waited in silence, each of them feeling that they would never be able to exchange thoughts until the final war came. The slab of iron ore lay silently in their midst, as if absorbing and collecting their thoughts and silently bearing witness. Hines said softly,
Have you heard about the wall breakers?
Tyler nodded.
The ETO just announced it on their public website, and it's been verified by the CIA.
The Wallfacers lapsed into silence again, each one conjuring in his mind an image of his own wallbreaker. It was an image that would appear countless times in their nightmares, for the day a wallbreaker actually appeared would likely spell the end of that Wallfacer. When Shi Xiaoming saw his father enter, he edged toward the corner, but Shi Qiang simply sat down quietly next to him.
"Don't be afraid. I won't hit you or curse at you this time. I don't have the energy."
He brought out a packet of cigarettes, took out two, and offered one to his son. Shi Xiaoming hesitated before accepting it. They lit up and smoked for a while in silence. Then Shi Qiang said,
"I've got a mission. I'll be leaving the country soon."
"What about your illness?"
Shi Xiaoming looked up through the smoke and gave his father a worried look.
"Let's talk about you first."
Shi Xiaoming's expression turned pleading.
"Dad, there's going to be a heavy sentence for this." "Any other crime, and I'd be able to work it out for you. But that's not how this is going to work. Ming, we're both adults. We need to be responsible for our actions."
Shi Xiaoming bowed his head in despair and took a silent draw on his cigarette. Shi Qiang said,
"I'm half to blame. I never had any concern for you when you were growing up. I came home late every night, so tired I'd just have a drink and then go to bed. I never went to a parents' meeting at school, and I never had a good talk with you about anything. It's the same thing again. We have to be responsible for our own actions."
Tears in his eyes, Shi Xiaoming ground the cigarette back and forth repeatedly on the edge of the bed, like he was extinguishing the latter half of his life.
"Prison is like a criminal training course. Forget about reform when you go in. Just don't get mixed up with the other prisoners and learn how to protect yourself a little. Take these."
Shi Qiang placed a plastic bag on the bed. Inside were two cartons of ordinary Yunyan cigarettes.
"And if you need anything else, your mother will send it to you."
Shi Qiang went to the door, then turned and said to his son,
"Ming, you may still meet your dad again. He'll probably be older than me at that point, and then you'll understand what's in my heart right now."
Through the small window in the door, Shi Xiaoming watched his father exit the detention center. From the back, he looked quite old. In an era where anxiety had taken hold of everything, Luo Ji was now the world's most laid-back man. He strolled beside the lake, took a boat out into the water, had the chef turn the mushrooms he picked and the fish he caught into tasty delicacies, browsed through the library's rich collection. And when he tired of that, went outside and golfed with the guards. He rode on horseback through the grassland and on the forest path in the direction of the snow peak, but he never reached the foot of the mountain. Oftentimes, he would sit on a bench on the lakeside and look at the mountain's reflection in the water, doing and thinking nothing as an entire day passed unknowingly. He was alone during this time, with no connection to the outside world. Kent was in the manor, too, but he had his own small office and rarely bothered him. Luo Ji had only spoken once to the officer in charge of security to ask that the security detail not trail along behind him, and if they absolutely had to make sure that he could not see them. He felt like the boat in the water, floating quietly with its sail furled, ignorant of where it was moored and not caring where it floated. Now and then, when he thought about his former life, he was surprised to discover that in the short space of a few days, he could no longer recognize it. This state satisfied him. He was particularly interested in the wine cellar. He knew that the dust-covered bottles lying horizontally on the racks held nothing but the best. He drank in the living room, he drank in the library, and sometimes he drank on the boat. But never too much, just enough to keep him in that perfect half-drunk, half-sober state, and then he would take out that long-stemmed pipe left by the previous owner and puff away. Even when it rained and the living room grew chilly, Luo Ji never had the fireplace lit. He knew it wasn't yet time. He never went online here, but he sometimes watched television, skipping over the news and watching programs that had nothing to do with current events or even the present day. This sort of content was still possible to find, although it was growing increasingly rare in the last ebbs of the Golden Age. Late one night he got carried away by a bottle of cognac that, from the label, was 35 years old. Wielding the remote, he skipped past the several news stations on the high-definition television, but one English-language news item caught his eye. It concerned the salvage of a mid-17th-century wreck, a clipper that had sailed from Rotterdam to Faradabad and had sunk off Cape Horn. Among the objects that divers had retrieved from the wreck was a small, sealed cask of fine wine that experts speculated was still drinkable. Not only that, but after 3 centuries in storage at the bottom of the ocean, its taste would be unparalleled. Luo Ji recorded most of the program and then called for Kent. "I want that cask. Buy it for me," he said. Kent went to make a call. 2 hours later, he told Luo Ji that the price of the cask was astonishingly high. Bidding would start at 300,000 euros.
"That amount is nothing to the Wallfacer project. Buy it. It's part of the plan."
And thus, the Wallfacer project produced a second idiom after the Wallfacer smile. Anything that was clearly absurd, but which had to be done anyway, was called part of the Wallfacer plan, or simply part of the plan. 2 days later, the cask, its aged surface covered in shells, was placed in the villa's living room. Luo Ji took out a tap with a twist drill specially made for wooden casks, which he found in the cellar, and carefully drilled it into the side to pour out the first glass. The liquid was a tempting emerald green. He sniffed it, and then put the glass to his lips.
"Doctor, is this part of the plan too?" Kent asked softly. "That's right. It's part of the plan."
Luo Ji was about to drink, but seeing the people present in the room, he said, "All of you, out." Kent and the rest of them did not move.
"Sending you out is part of the plan too. Out."
He glared at them. Kent gently shook his head and led the others out. Luo Ji took a sip. Although he did his utmost to convince himself that the flavour was heavenly, in the end he did not have the guts to take a second sip. But that one sip didn't let him go unscathed. That night he was sick out both ends until he spat up bile the colour of the wine, and his body was so weak he couldn't get out of bed. Later, after doctors and experts opened the cask lid, they found that it had a rather large brass label on the inside wall, as was the custom in those days. Over time, there had been some sort of reaction between the normally peacefully coexisting copper and the wine, and some sort of substance had dissolved into the wine. When the cask was carried off, Luo Ji could see the schadenfreude on Kent's face. Deeply exhausted, he lay in bed watching his IV drip. An intense loneliness seized him. He knew that his recent leisure was merely the weightlessness of tumbling into the abyss of loneliness, and now he had reached the bottom. But he had anticipated this moment, and he had been prepared. He was waiting for someone, and then the next step of the plan would begin. He was waiting for Da Shi. Tyler stood holding an umbrella against the Kagoshima drizzle. Behind him, 2 meters away, stood Defense Chief Koichi Inoue, whose umbrella remained unopened. The past 2 days he had maintained the same separation from Tyler, both physically and mentally. They were at the Chiran Peace Museum for kamikaze pilots, and in front of them was a statue of a special attack unit next to a white plane, call sign 502. A light layer of rain painted the surface of the statue and the aircraft and made them deceptively lifelike.
"Isn't there any room for discussion of my proposal?" Tyler asked.
"I strongly advise you not to speak of this to the media. It will cause trouble."
Koichi Inoue's words were as icy as the rain.
"Is it still that sensitive, even today?"
"What's sensitive isn't the history, but your proposal to restore the kamikaze special attack units."
"Why don't you do it in the US or some other place? Are the Japanese people the only ones in the world who can die out of duty?"
Tyler closed up his umbrella and drew closer to Koichi Inoue, who, although he didn't recoil, seemed to have a force field surrounding him that prevented Tyler from getting close.
"I've never said that the future kamikaze forces would be made up of only Japanese members. It's an international force, but since it originated in your great country, isn't it only natural to revive it here?"
"In interplanetary war, does this mode of attack really have any significance? You should realize that victories for those special attack units were limited, and they didn't turn the tide of battle."
"Commander, sir, the Space Force I have established is a fleet of fighters equipped with super-hydrogen bombs."
"Why do you need humans? Can't computer-controlled fighters get close enough to attack?"
This question seemed to give Tyler the opportunity he was waiting for, and he grew excited.
"That's exactly the problem. Today's computers are unable to replace human brains, and advancements in fundamental theory would be necessary for quantum and other next-gen computers. But that's been locked up by the Sofons. So, 4 centuries from now, computing intelligence will still be limited, and human-controlled weapons will be indispensable. To tell you the truth, reviving the kamikaze squads only has moral significance now, because it will be 10 generations before any of them go to their death. But establishing that spirit and faith means starting now."
Koichi Inoue turned around to face Tyler for the first time. His wet hair was plastered against his forehead, and the raindrops on his face looked like tears.
"That approach violates the basic moral principles of modern society. Human lives come first, and the state and the government can't require any individual to take up a death mission. I seem to remember a line Yang Wen-li said in Legend of the Galactic Heroes: 'In this war lies the fate of the country. But what does it matter next to individual rights and freedoms?' All of you just do your best."
Tyler sighed. "You know what? You have thrown away your most precious resource."
Then he snapped open his umbrella and turned and walked angrily away. When he reached the gate of the memorial, he looked back and saw Koichi Inoue still standing in the rain before the statue. As Tyler walked in the sea breeze, his mind returned to a sentence from a suicide note from a kamikaze pilot to his mother that he had seen in the exhibit. "Mum, I'm going to be a firefly."
"It's worse than I imagined," Alan said to Ray Diaz. They were standing next to a black obelisk made of lava rock, the monument marking ground zero of humankind's first atom bomb.
"Is its structure really that different?" Ray Diaz asked.
"Totally different from today's nuclear bombs. Constructing its mathematical model might be more than 100 times more complicated than today's bombs. This is an enormous undertaking."
"What do I need to do?"
"Cosmo's on your staff, right? Get him to come to my lab."
"William Cosmo?"
"Yes, but he's an astrophysicist,
an authority on stars.
What's he going to do?
That's what I'm going to tell you. To your mind, a nuclear bomb is detonated and then explodes, but the actual process is more like burning. The greater the yield, the longer the combustion. A 20-megaton nuclear explosion, for example, has a fireball that can last for over 20 seconds. The superbomb we're designing is 200 megatons, and its fireball will burn for several minutes. Think about that. What will it look like?
A small sun?
Correct. Its fusion structure is very like that of a star, and it reproduces stellar evolution over a very abbreviated period. So the mathematical model we need to construct is essentially the model of a star.
White sands stretched out in front of them. In the moments just before dawn, the details of the dark desert couldn't be made out. As they gazed at the scenery, they were involuntarily reminded of the basic setting of Three Body.
"I'm very excited, Mr. Ray Diaz. Please forgive me for our lack of enthusiasm at the start. Looking at the project now, the significance far exceeds the construction of a superbomb itself. Do you know what we're doing? We're creating a virtual star."
Ray Diaz shook his head in disapproval.
"What does that have to do with the defense of Earth?"
"Don't be limited by planetary defense. Me and my colleagues in the lab are scientists, after all. Besides, this thing is not without practical significance. So long as you input the appropriate parameters, the star could be a model for our sun. Think about it. It's always useful to have the sun in your computer memory. It's the biggest presence that's close to us in the cosmos. But we could take more advantage of it. The model may have many more discoveries lying in wait."
Ray Diaz said,
"One previous use of the sun is what brought humanity to the brink, and brought you and me to this place. But new discoveries might bring humanity back. So today, I've invited you here to watch the sunrise."
The rising sun was now just peeking its head over the horizon. The desert in front of them came into focus like a developing photograph. Ray Diaz could see that this place, once blasted by the fires of hell, was now covered in sparse undergrowth.
"I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," Alan exclaimed.
"What?" Ray Diaz whipped his head around as if someone had shot him from behind.
"Oppenheimer said that when he watched the first nuclear explosion. I think it's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita."
The wheel in the east expanded rapidly, casting light across the earth like a golden web. The same sun was there on that morning when Ye Wen Jie had turned the red shore antenna, and even before that the same sun had shone upon the dust settling after the first bomb blast. Australopithecus, 1 million years ago, and the dinosaurs 100 million years ago, had turned their dull eyes upon this very sun, and even earlier than that, the hazy light that penetrated the surface of the primeval ocean and was felt by the first living cell was emitted by this same sun.
Alan went on. "And then a man called Bainbridge followed up Oppenheimer's statement with something completely non-poetic. Now we are all sons of bitches."
"What are you talking about?" Ray Diaz said. Watching the rising sun, his breathing became ragged.
"I'm thanking you, Mr. Ray Diaz, because from now on, we're not sons of bitches."
In the east, the sun rose in overarching solemnity, as if declaring to the world, "Everything is as fleeting as a shadow before me."
"What's the matter, Mr. Ray Diaz?"
Alan saw that Ray Diaz had fallen into a crouch, one hand on the ground, and was convulsing in dry heaves. His face had turned pale and was covered in a cold sweat,
and he had no strength to move his hand from the clump of thorns it was pressing on.
"Go to the car," he said weakly.
He turned his head in the direction opposite the sun, and he raised his other hand to block the sunlight. He was unable to get up. Alan tried to assist, but couldn't budge his stocky body.
"Drive the car over,"
Ray Diaz wheezed out while pulling his hand back to cover his eyes. When Alan drove over to him, he had fallen to the ground. With difficulty, Alan helped him into the back seat.
"Sunglasses. I need sunglasses."
He half reclined into the back seat, his hands clawing at the air. Alan handed Ray Diaz a pair of sunglasses he found on the dashboard. After he put them on, his breathing grew smoother.
"I'm all right. Let's get out of here, quickly," he said feebly.
"What on earth happened? What's wrong?"
"It might be the sun."
"Huh? When did you start having this sort of reaction?"
"Just now."
The peculiar phobia for the sun that afflicted Ray Diaz pushed him to the edge of mental and physical breakdown whenever he saw it, and kept him confined indoors from then on.
"Was the flight very long? You look like you don't have any energy,"
was the first thing Luo Ji said after Shi Qiang arrived.
"Yeah, you'll never find a plane as comfortable as that one we were on,"
Shi Qiang said as he appraised his surroundings.
"Not bad, eh?"
"It's awful,"
Shi Qiang said, shaking his head.
"Woods on three sides, so it's easy to hide close to the house, and there's a lake. With the shore this close to the house, it would be difficult to defend against divers coming from the woods on the other side. But the surrounding grassland is pretty good, and provides some open space."
"Can't you be any more romantic?"
"I'm here to work, my boy."
"It's romantic work I'm thinking of." Luo Ji led Shi Qiang into the living room. He surveyed it, but did not seem much impressed by the luxury and elegance. Luo Ji poured him a drink in a crystal goblet, but Shi Qiang turned it down with a wave of his hand.
"It's 30-year-old aged brandy." "I can't drink right now. Tell me of this romantic work of yours."
Luo Ji sipped his brandy and sat down next to him.
"Dasha, I'm asking you to do me a favour. In your old job, did you ever have to look across the entire country for a particular person or even around the world?"
"Yes."
"Were you good at it?"
"At finding people, of course."
"Great. Help me find a person, a woman in her early 20s. This is part of the plan."
"Nationality, name, address?"
"None. The possibility that she even exists in the world is low."
Shi Qiang looked at him, and after a few seconds said,
"You dreamed her?"
Luo Ji nodded. "Daydreams too." Shi Qiang nodded too, then said something Luo Ji had not expected him to say.
"Okay."
"What?"
"Okay, so long as you know what she looks like."